I'm Joe Wood, and I believe.
April 23rd, 2007, over the English Channel, Captain Ray Boyer is piloting a routine passenger flight from Southampton to the Channel Islands. During the flight, Boyer and his passengers have clear views of two identical, seemingly stationary UFOs for around 15 minutes. The witnesses say the objects emanate a brilliant yellow light. The pilot of another plane, 25 miles south of Boyer, also sees the objects. Radar traces register the presence of the two objects, but investigators suggest the traces are reflections from cargo ferries in the channel. Boyer maintains the objects were not and could not have been manufactured on Earth based on his 18 years of aviation experience.
Welcome to Alien Nation, the show about extraterrestrials and UFOs, asking the question, are we alone? In Alien Nation, I talk to other Earthlings about their otherworldly encounters, and we love hearing your stories, so please get in touch. I'll tell you how to do that at the end of the show. My guest today was a first-hand witness of one of the most important UFO encounters ever, the Rendlesham Forest Incident, and author of the book The Rendlesham Enigma. Welcome to Alien Nation, Sergeant Jim Penniston.
How you doing there? Can I call you Joe?
Yes, definitely. Can I call you Jim? Or would you like me to call you Sergeant Jim?
Absolutely. No.
Okay.
God, no. I've been out for 20 years, so...
Okay.
No, I'm retired. You know what? We'll say that for the officers. Those guys like to be called by their retired rank, those guys, for some reason. I don't know why.
So, Jim, I am fascinated about your story because I was down in the country the other day visiting my friend Mairead, and I went to Rendlesham Forest just so that I could say I'd been there. But you have the most famous UFO... it's our most famous UFO encounter in the UK, I feel. And you were there and you touched a UFO. Can you tell us the story from your perspective?
Yeah, I'll try to keep it short.
Okay.
It was right after Christmas, 1980, yeah. Boxing Day. We were working 12-hour shifts, security. And law enforcement, they're separate than us, and they were working 8-hour shifts. Yeah. And I had just posted everybody at Woodbridge. I was a Woodbridge supervisor.
So let me just ask you, what were you doing security-wise? What were you being, were you making sure nobody came into the Army base, or what is it? What was it?
Well, it was an Air Force base. And... yes, and my job as a security supervisor is to protect the 10,000 people that were at the bases. It was that's including civilians, and that's including dependents and active duty. And the twin bases were operated under Bentwaters. I mean, that's where all the control centers were, and that. And my job was to protect the resources there, which were like, you know, six squadrons of A-10 aircraft and all personnel. And anytime that the base was going to be in, it was an interesting time with the Cold War. We were constantly, you know, with the ports being so close, like Felixstowe, Lowestoft.
Yeah,
we had a lot of. Cargo ships coming in, they're Russian, you know, Soviet, and staffed. And so we had a lot of infiltration going on at the time without getting in too much detail about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a tense time while everybody else was having a great time in England.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Anyway, the night started pretty much as usual. I had done, you know, mundane stuff. You know, I had got everybody posted, along with the security response team, Sergeant McCulley. He got everybody else posted. And I was doing mundane things like security lighting check for the perimeters. All that is to check what light bulbs are burned out, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I had done all that, and I was going to meet Sergeant McCulley. You know, when I got there, it was around midnight. McCulley says, "Hear the radio transmission. CC wants to talk to you." I says, "No, I didn't hear it." So we had a direct line that went directly to Central Security Control. Yeah, he says, we have a situation out there at the East Gate. And I said, okay, what kind? He says, I'll brief you when you get there, which was just completely odd because that never happened, okay? Yeah. I said, okay. He says, I want you to run code 2, which that's with our lights on. I said, what's going on out there? He said, nothing dangerous. Just, you know, you'll get briefed by the law enforcement patrol when you get there. So I took off for the East Gate. Ran code 2. That takes about 2 or 3 minutes to get there at, you know, 45, 50 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And when I arrived, Sergeant Steffens, the senior law enforcement guy, I said, what's going on, Bud? And that's his name, Bud Steffens. He said, over there in the forest, and he was pointing over in the rentals room.
Yeah.
And I could see activity. I could see what appeared to be maybe a fire or something like that in the forest. I could see a dome of a light over the forest canopy. And I says, what do you think it was? I says, did it land? He goes, oh no. I said, did it crash? He says, no, it landed. And that's impossible. I don't, you've been to Rendlesham Forest.
Yeah.
The trees back then are 5-6 feet apart. I mean, there's nothing that can land in there. And so I'm trying to convince Sergeant Steffens that nothing could land in the forest. And he says, no, he says it landed over there. And I said, okay. So I went to the East Gate, is a gate shack there, and it has a direct line to law enforcement. I call law enforcement, says, put me through the security control. Once I arrived there, it was a security situation anyway. It was no law enforcement.
Yeah.
And so when you put it in perspective, when the phone call was picked up, I had 5 people on the line, and it was, you know, like the shift commander, the senior controller, the comm plotter. I mean, all these guys are on there. Mm. And I says, well, we got some type of activity. I says, adjacent to the East Gate, maybe 150 yards. I said, appears to be a fire. And during that time, Sergeant Coffey, the senior controller, was contacting Eastern Radar, which is British, and Heathrow Radar, and they got triangulation. There was a bogey, a craft that didn't have a transponder, like a civilian aircraft.
Yeah.
Over the base, they lost contact with it about 15 minutes ago. So that was now an emergency situation because it was pretty much confirmed that there's a possibility of an aircraft crash outside the base. So we implemented the security response option for off-base aircraft crashes. I got 2 airmen with me, 1 security airman, 1 law enforcement airman. Yeah. And I was supposed to do is take the crash kit, go out there, set up an entry control point, call in where it's at for the first responders to come, like fire department, stuff like that. And then to the crash scene, which is usually to see if there's classified there and things like that.
Yeah.
And so we deployed off. Yeah, we deployed off base without weapons because it was a crash and there's no reason to go off base without weapons or with them anyway. Besides the status of forces agreement, at the time, the British, they were just really insane about these weapons stuff, you know, for us traveling off base with automatic weapon.
Oh, really?
So anyway, we couldn't go any farther, and so I said, well, I'll establish the entry control point right there. So I called in the grid coordinates from the plotting board.
Yeah.
And I was also having radio difficulty, which is impossible there because we had radio repeaters all over those twin bases. I mean, you couldn't have a void in the radios.
Yeah.
But I was having them. And so I told Aaron Kabanzak, the security airman, to, besides being the entry controller for the responding forces, I said, I want you to go ahead and relay any information I transmit, you know, to the East Gate. And in the meantime, Sergeant Chandler, who was the flight sergeant from Bentwaters, was en route to the East Gate to take my position over.
Yeah.
Since I was no longer on the base. Well, at the time, you never know. You know, it could have been a security situation, could have been aircraft downing. It could have been a ruse, you know, just to go ahead and preoccupy a response force and then hit somewhere else. I mean, there's a lot of things, a lot of factors going on.
Yeah. And, could have been the enemy.
You never know. We trained for everything with the Soviets at the time, Warsaw Pact nations. We were prepared for most anything,
except what was there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. At least from my perspective. Anyway, as we got closer, you could start seeing in the tree line, the different color lights, red, yellow, blue. And I could still see the white light over the top of the canopy of the forest, like it was like a bubble over it.
Yeah.
And, at that time, I'd probably been to 20, 22, 23, I don't know exactly, aircraft crashes. I've been to so many, it's ridiculous. And it didn't have none of the features, none of the hallmarks of an aircraft crash. The color wasn't right. I couldn't think burning. I couldn't smell nothing, like fuel or anything like that.
No noise?
No, it was absolutely no noise at all.
Gosh.
And so got to the perimeter of the forest, and I'm still, taking, I had my camera with me from the crash kit. So I was taking pictures there as I approached anyway. And ran out of film. I did run out. At those times, you had actual,
film.
35 millimeter film. I mean, And so when I got to the perimeter, at that point in time, I was still in contact with Kabanzak, who was at the entry control point, and I was, doing my security checks. Security's A-OK, all kind of stuff. And knowing it wasn't an aircraft crash. At that point in time, I terminated the security response option for aircraft crash, and I implemented the helping hand situation. And what that is a security situation exists that could be hostile to the base, and it's telephonically up-channeled, through the command post, and then Third Air Force, and then Ramstein, and then finally to the Pentagon. And so I implemented the helping hand situation because I thought it was a security threat at that point in time because there still wasn't no sound. And I was starting to feel, really crazy sensations, physically.
Did you feel nervous about going near it? Did it make you feel nervous?
Not at this point in time because all I could see is a bright light within the woods, and it was somewhat dissipating, and anyway, the physical effects I was feeling was like static electricity on my face and clothes, hair.
Oh, really?
And I thought initially it might be adrenaline or something like that, because I was a little excited, but I thought it might be that, but it continued. It didn't stop, so which was odd. And then as I went into the tree line, I found my movements becoming labored.
Oh, my
goodness. Now, I have, like you'd be waist-deep walking through a pool of water. Yeah, that's the type of resistance I was feeling. And at this point in time, still no sound. And then there was a... bright light just encapsulated the whole area. And so I hit the ground. The law enforcement guy with me, who was about 25 feet to my rear right, hit the ground as well. And then not hearing an explosion, I just reacted. There's no explosion. And the light then started to dissipate, going back down again and getting dimmer. I got up and I could see the entry controller back to my left rear, which is maybe 100 yards, maybe 25 yards back. And then the law enforcement airman, who was 25 feet maybe, and he was motionless, and so was the entry controller.
Yep.
And as I came up to the berm, there's earthen berms, they're about 5 feet. It's part of the forestry's replanting stuff. I started up over the berm of Earth, and this light now dissipating down. I mean, it's now where I can, I'm not squinting no more and stuff like that. And as it dissipated, I could see triangular black opaque type craft forming in this light. And finally, the light just dissipated, and there sat this craft on the forest floor. And
how big was the craft? Would you say?
Well, I measured it later. It wasn't very big. I mean, not as far as aircraft goes. So I paced it off, and it was about 9 feet long, equilateral on each side, and it had colors that was running through the fabric, the skin of the craft, and they eventually just slowed down and finally disappeared, and all that was there is a black craft.
So it's actually black, yet beforehand you could see colors in the material that the craft is made out of.
Correct. Yeah, finally the coloring dissipated in it, which was, it was like globular type lighting, maybe measuring like 10, 15 inches, I'm guessing there.
Yeah.
And finally it just dissipated, and it was just black. And I'll tell you what was interesting is there was still light coming from underneath the craft. So as I approached it, okay, I wasn't having to struggle as much as I did. And it stretched out maybe 10 feet on each side of it. And it created like a light, a wall of light maybe around the, this 15, 20-foot bubble area. The physical effects started to dissipate. Mm. And so I'm wondering, I'm out of film, so now all I can do, I cannot contact even Kabanzak now. On the radio. So I continued to make my security checks and continued to talk on the radio just to make sure in case they could hear me, even though I couldn't hear them, at least they would have some type of transcript of what was going on. And I still couldn't figure out what this light is coming from underneath the craft, and
so
I wasn't sure if I was going to survive it.
Did you realize it was a UFO or... Because you must have been confused and, thinking, what the hell is this?
Well, I never believed in anything like that, okay?
Oh, really?
Of course not. I mean, those are loony people that believe in that kind of stuff. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
And, And I was more secure. I was running my security response option for a helping hand, and I was more worried about security of the base. The technology, it was advanced.
So you had never seen anything like that before. Did you think it was like a war weapon?
I wasn't sure what I was looking at, so I was going to investigate. I went up to it. I looked underneath the craft. I see no landing gear, but it was somehow fixed to the above the ground.
So it was
and
hovering.
All was coming out was light, and then. No, it was not hovering. It was above the ground. No apparent landing gear. There was light coming out from underneath it. There was indentions in the ground, three of them. You could see them. It was a technology. I'm calling it light. Obvious, it's a technology I didn't understand.
Yeah.
But it was just to make sure it was fixed above the forest floor, I actually pushed on it to see if I could move it. I mean, obviously, if you had like a car out there and you went up to a car and you pushed it, you're going to get some movement. I mean, even though it's on the ground, you get, move an inch or two. This did not move at all.
So it had it was fixed above the ground and it had nothing that was fixing it.
Well, other than the what appeared to be light coming out from underneath it.
So it was fixed with light. That's mad.
Yeah, that white light. Yeah, it was some kind of technology. I just didn't understand it. Then I started, besides pacing it off, I was taking notes and all that. I was going to do a 360 walk around, check out the whole craft. And I'm still transmitting on the radio, saying I'm okay, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I told him I'm investigating a downed aircraft of some sort. You know, I didn't know what. Anyway, as I walked around, I could see on the craft that there was writing of some sort on it. So I actually felt somewhat relieved when I seen there was some type of writing on it, thinking, you know, it was going to have a star sickle on it. Says Nassau experimental. I don't know anything.
Yeah.
I was pretty much relieved to see that. And so as I approached it, though, this wasn't written like in numbers, and it wasn't written in like letters. It was like pictorial glyphs on the side of the craft.
How fascinating!
So I wrote them down in my notebook, I measured them out. They measured about 3 feet wide. That's how far my arms went out, and there was bottom glyphs that stretched along the bottom of it. They were about 4 or 5 inches high, using my hand for measurement.
Hmm.
And then from the craft was very smooth to touch.
Was it hot or was it cold?
It was like black glass.
Yeah.
It was warm.
Oh, it was warm.
It was warm, and I contributed. I mean, based on the air temperature out there, it was probably freezing.
Yeah.
I would think the air temperature. It was it was probably more like around 45, 50 degrees, the skin of the craft. I don't know that exactly. That's an estimate. And so it was warm to touch. It was also very smooth, like black glass.
Oh.
And then when I get to the pictorials, the actual glyphs, it went from very smooth to like rough, like sandpaper.
Huh.
Like these glyphs were etched within the skin of the craft.
Some futuristic drone or something like that, maybe it was.
Well, it was small. I mean, it 9 feet, that's pretty small.
Yeah.
When you're looking like an F-15 or something, you know, that's sitting at 24 feet long, you know? I mean, it's awful small. And so I started looking for things that all airplanes have. All aircraft have these. I looked for flaps, it had none. I looked for aerons, it had none. I looked for crew compartments, it did not have any. I looked for
a door?
Doors. I looked for windows, it had nothing like that. It was just
void of all those things.
It was even void of like rivets. It didn't have rivets like
really?
Regular airplanes. Yeah, it was just completely smooth. And then it had, you know, I said it was like 6.5 feet high, but
so
that was off the ground above.
So it could have had somebody inside, but you obviously couldn't.
Oh, no.
No?
No, it's too small.
Too small, okay.
No, it's too small for that. That's why I was looking for those types of things that, you know, all aircraft must have.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's a dorsal fin of it, the stuck up from the craft, and that was about 6.5 feet high. And So it just was too small. And so I said, okay, so this is the man. I was pretty sure of that. And at that time, there was no such thing as drone aircraft or...
Yeah.
They didn't have stuff like that.
Those hieroglyphics are fascinating. You said you've got them drawn. Did anybody try and translate them?
Yes. Matter of fact, without giving their names out, because they're still employed by universities, one of them's in Cambridge.
Oh, okay.
The guy, they'll end up, what they're fearful of is losing their funding for research, I guess. I don't know. I guess they don't want to be public. But they're part of the Rendlesham research team that we formed about 10 years ago. And part of it is they believe it's mathematical, the glyphs. That's the origin, it's math. And that's what this professor from Cambridge said. And as a matter of fact, he did it on camera. He did it on James Fox documentary, I Know What I Saw. I'm pretty sure that was in that documentary.
Yeah.
So it was mathematical. And that will stay the course throughout the years, because everything about the whole incident is mathematics. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, and anyway, in this, my current book, The Rendlesham Enigma, which is the definitive book, I want you to know that. Definitive, meaning everything I knew, I wrote in there.
Okay.
And there's so much. I tell you what, pretty much when I talk at a conference, speak there, I tell everybody to start out with, I says, how many people know about the Rendlesham Forest incident? And of course, you've got everybody raises their hand. Yeah. And I said, okay, half of what you know isn't true.
Oh, really?
That's the reason I had to write the book. There's so much disinformation out there. It was crazy. People are trying to make a buck off this. I can't believe that.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy.
Well, I'm glad you've written a book. I can't wait to read it, actually. But in your new book, you talk about the code within the code. What's that?
Well, I'll tell you what, Joe. Going back to the glyphs.
Yeah.
In there, it's such detail. I tell you which ones I seen first, which ones I touched. I go through it, and here's the deal.
Yeah.
Chapters 3 and 4, when you read that in the book, you're going to be with me. That, and I'll tell you that right now as the reader. You're going to be right there. It took me months to write those two chapters. I kept going back to them and going back to them. And you're saying, well, geez, Jim, you got a great memory. No, not really. I don't have a great memory. But one thing I did use in all my entire military career, Air Force career, I kept journals for 20 plus years. And I was at Bentwaters from July 1980 to July 1984. And I kept daily journals every day. So I used those journals, wrote that information down. I kept notes from my notebook. The drawings were all done at the time. I mean, all that stuff was done at the instant. And matter of fact, the notebook and the code within the code, I had went around the second time. Let me get to that. I went around the second time. I'm still curious because there's glyphs are spread out over 3 feet. But above the other glyphs is this one. There's a triangular one. And it had a big circle around it, and it was about the size of a pie plate. And that one fascinated me the most. So I just touched it. And when I touched it, I was just blinded by intense white light. I mean, it was just so bright, I couldn't see nothing at all but forming of ones and zeros. That's all I could see, ones and zeros, ones and zeros. What the hell is this? And I sort of gained my wits about me, and I just lifted my hand off and went away. Then I call it light. It wasn't light. I'll tell you why it wasn't light. Because the forest is pitch black at night. And anything bright like that would have ruined my night vision. It would have took 40 minutes or so for my night vision to come back. And it was instantaneous. I had night vision. So it wasn't light. I'm just calling it that because I have no idea what it was. Anyway, so we did the investigation. I finally get around to it, and I start seeing this color start moving again throughout the craft. So I back away. I get a good 10, 15 feet away. And it started going, you know, more activity. I got on the ground because I thought, you know, it was going to explode or something. Maybe I activated something by touching it. You know, I didn't know. And it started to lift off of the ground, no sound. It started to move back through the trees. And by the way, that's impossible, okay, because the craft measured 9 feet. I know that for sure. And the trees are only 5 to 6 feet apart. So how does it do that?
So it sort of went into reverse.
20 feet. Yes, it got about 20 more feet away from me. Then it lifted up to the canopy of the trees with no air disturbance at all, no sound, and it made a slight right turn, and then it was gone in a blink of an eye.
God, what is that technology?
Yeah, I know. It's at first I thought it just disappeared, but because we had a second visual of it later on when we What had happened is at that point, the airman I discounted. All of a sudden, I could hear stuff. He was beside me. I hear the tree, the breakage of foliage on the ground. It's him. He reacquires it. He said, but the forest is so thick, there's no way you could reacquire anything. And he took off in the middle of the heading out in the middle of the forest. And one of the things that you do in the military is you got to keep your integrity of your two-man team. You don't leave your team member ever. He did.
So he just ran off and left. He ran off and left you there.
He said he seen something. You know, there's no way he could have seen anything. It was too dark. I mean, the forest was thick. There's just no way. And so I took off after him. We didn't go that far. It was maybe 50, 60 feet because the forest was cut down so fast. We come to two fences, and one was barbed wire. And he jumped them, and he took off across the farmer's field. I'm behind him. In the middle of this farmer's field, it's sort of, even though it's winter, there was like ice breaking water on the middle of the field, and you know, you could hear the ice breaking. I fell down a few times chasing. I was wet. I finally get to past the farmers' houses and stuff like that, and he finally stops. I says, "What are you chasing?" And he goes, I'm chasing that UFO. And I said, where is it? I said, I don't see it. So he points in the opposite direction toward the coast. And I says, I don't see what you're looking at. And he says, here, look down my arm. He says, look down my arm and you'll be able to see it. And on the horizon was this faint light. I said, that's the lighthouse. Yeah, can you believe that? And that's what he wrote that in a statement, and that's where they get all this BS stuff from, like Red Path and stuff like that.
Why did he say that then? He just didn't want to accept the truth.
I don't know what he was. He was like, he was very agitated. And he was very, you'll see this in the book. You'll see, just he was in an uncontrolled situation. Now, he was young. I mean, he was like 19 years old. He'd probably been in the service a couple of years. I don't know. You know, who knows? Inexperienced, handling crisis situations. I don't know. He didn't do well. So I'm looking around. I said, that's the lighthouse. And he's looking around. And I see the craft again, the canopy over at Reynolds Forest. But this is more of the Keeble Green area.
Yeah.
And it's just sitting there. So I'm getting ready to go back over there. Okay. It wasn't that far. It's maybe 150, 200 yards. And then it just made a finally steady movement toward the coastline. I mean, I don't know. I can guesstimate maybe a few hundred miles an hour. I don't know. I couldn't really guesstimate. It's hard to do that at night anyway.
Yeah.
And eventually it was gone. We weren't that far from the coastline. It's only like 4 miles away. I mean,
yeah.
Immediately after I lost visual of that, though, I had radio contact again with security control.
Yeah.
And,
lost all radio signal whilst it was there.
I could not hear them, but I find out later when I went in to do the 1569, the incident and complaint report, which is a long version of writing everything out that happened. And I wrote all the times down. You know, I was going to go ahead and provide it to the Central Security Control. And so when I went into the control center, I says, for 1569, Sergeant Coffey said, I already got it. I said, what do you mean? I just wrote everything down you said. And I said, so you could hear me? He goes, yes, they could hear me. And I tell you what's key about this. This is in the book, too. The only recordings that were ever made on that base were audio recordings. And they were done with the old reel-to-reel, teak reel-to-reels, if you remember those. They were done at the wing command post. And what they would do is record all radio transmissions for security, fire department, command element. They would record them for 72 hours. And then they would go ahead and rewind it and start it all over again. So you always had a record. those are the recordings that General Gabriel from Ramstein came in and got from the base a couple days later. Those there are actually the, I would love to have them be declassified because they tell exactly what happened, you know? Yeah, and probably a little bit more than what you want to know, because I had a rough time out there with this. So, you know, and when you're not thinking everybody's hearing you and you're just talking on the radio, you know, all kinds of stuff comes out.
Do they still have those recordings then?
Well, General Gabriel, he's the commander, four-star general, came in personally from Ramstein, which is out of really odd, and came and picked them up a couple days later, and then they went to the Pentagon. I'm sure they're still top secret. So once they get released, you know, then you have everything, you know, about what happened that night. But until then, you're going to have to read the book.
Well, that was the first part of my conversation with Jim Penniston, who was on the scene at the famous Rendlesham Forest UFO incident. Next week, he'll tell us what happened after and about his book, The Rendlesham Enigma. That's our show for today. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please rate us on whatever platform you get your podcast from. It helps people like you find us. Today's show was produced by Mike Hansen for Pod People Productions. Theme music by Mike Hansen and Jamie Allen. Special thanks to Nigel Heath and our narrator, Mike Hansen Sr. If you want to share your stories, we'd love to hear from you. Just email info@podpeopleproductions.co.uk. Subject matter, Alien Nation. Beam me up next time. I'm Joe Wood. And I believe. Pod People.